coming for the kickoff reading, our annual kickoff reading, and there's no better reader to kick it off than Jim Harms. A few announcements before we launch into the introduction. Jim's children, Walt and Phoebe, will be selling his books at the table. Seriously, no, this is serious. And just try to sneak by with paying less and see what kind of repercussions there are over there. There will be repercussions. Walt's a magician, so watch out. Jim has generously said he would donate $2 of every book sold tonight to what's known as COW, which is the Council of Writers. They're MFA students' organization that does many wonderful things, including printing up a publication and giving excellent readings. So thank you, Jim, for volunteering $2 from every book. The water, by the way, under here is fresh, it's yours, hasn't been touched. And I'm Mark Brazidis, by the way, the director of the Creative Writing Program. On behalf of Donald Hall and Laura Brady and Tim Sweet, we'd like to thank you all. And the English department, we'd like to thank you all for being here. I once overheard Jim Harms say that listening to his iPod had helped his poetry. If such a pronouncement had come from a student or from another writer, I might say, right, and sitting on your couch all day helps you prepare to run a marathon. But in Jim's case, there's no arguing with the results. His latest book, After West, and the poems he has written since are beautifully musical and beautifully meaningful. Whether poems that Jim wrote under the influence of his iPod will receive an asterisk in future editions of his books is up to voting members of the Poetry Hall of Fame. But poems he wrote about musicians, while under the influence of music, must certainly be exempt. After a poem Jim wrote about the rock group REM's album Murmur appeared in the Oxford American, the band showered him with gifts of CDs, posters, and other mementos. I think Michael Stipe was even willing to come sing at Walt's 9th birthday party. Walt, however, preferred a professional magician. Okay, it was actually his daughter's, Phoebe's, 8th birthday party. I'm joking. The REM care package, though, is true. And so I immediately sat down and wrote a poem about Fiona Apple. So far, nothing. Maybe I don't have enough poet friends, but Jim is the only poet I know who was once called back for an encore. It's time poets like musicians had radio channels dedicated to their work. If I were the DJ presiding over the inaugural hour of Jim Harms Radio, I would naturally list Jim's accomplishments, his 5 full-length collections of poetry, all with Carnegie Mellon University Press, his 3 pushcart prizes. Consider even being nominated for a pushcart prize is regarded as an honor. To win 3 is just plain greedy. His National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, his Penn Revson Fellowship, his publications in this country's finest literary journals, including Poetry, the Kenyon Review, the Gettysburg Review, American Poetry Review, and Plowshares, his masterful 14-year service as director of WVU's Creative Writing Program, his impressive and important work as director of the West Virginia Writers Workshop, which every 3rd week of July turns Morgantown, and by extension the whole state, into a literary haven, his numerous teaching and research awards. And then I'd get to push play. I'd get to start up the music, like this. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Harms.
Mark, thanks for all of you to be here. This has been a wonderful crowd, and I'm promising an eccentric selection of poems because I've been doing a lot of readings for the last 6 months, and so I'm trying to read poems that I don't read very often, which is not always easy because you tend to rely on the ones that are most familiar. We're really lucky to have Mark now directing the program, and it's really wonderful to be introduced by him because he puts so much thought into the way he thinks about people and their writing. It's very lucky to be here. I wanted to start, though, with a poem about my mom. And it was difficult to admit to myself at some point that I had never written a poem about my mother and that she had probably noticed. So a couple times back when I was out there, I took her aside and said, "The reason I've never written a poem about you is because we have a really good relationship." You notice all the ones about Dad? But it was important that I think about that. So this poem's set in the Central Valley of California where she lives. She used to live surrounded by almond orchards. Nobody in California lives surrounded by much other than houses these days, but there's still a few nearby. It's in its own way a very lovely place. The thing I loved in thinking about my mother was, you know, her example of how to love well. So this poem was called "A Friday at the End of August." At the northern end of the valley, they're shaking the almond trees again. My mother's teeth begin to ache about 5, just as the tractors retract their mechanical arms and let go of the trunks. Then she hears what's been lost all afternoon, the stolen song of a sole mockingbird nesting in a fence post, the pool sweep hissing as it plunges and cleans, Jean in the garage sawing boards for a new bureau. And beneath the dull whine, the trill and sizzle, a fleck of voice gathers with the wet music from a pocket radio. A word or two she remembers from her years along the border, the shavings of Spanish chipping the dusty air at the end of the street, where she knows, since her fillings hurt, since the workday is settling with blown dirt in the orchard beyond the cul-de-sac, where she knows a half dozen migrant workers, what her father-in-law called wetbacks, are singing with their whine. Their cold pink wine hidden for hours in the mud of an aqueduct and now unburied, uncorked, the mockingbird trying to get it right, this new song, new words arriving in pieces, solamente una vez, no más, the bones of language hung as always with laughter, with music, so many almonds drying in the dirt beneath the trees, the tractor parked at the end of the last row, a smudge pot and a litter of cards, the lost deck from last Friday. My mother walks out on the patio to sing along, the oleander's blue shade softening the heat. She knows the words, remembers a cantina above the river. And here's Jean with a glass of good Modesto wine, nothing fancy but cold, the pool in shadow, the day retreating, a blade of light dulled by now, the last cut deep and wet in the blue-black Pacific. "How about a swim?" Jean says, his voice amid song and silence, his voice and all the others, the border music, the psalm of evening. You're so quiet. All right. Let's not be reverent. There's nothing reverential about these poems. This is a poem I think I've read this aloud once, but I'm ashamed to admit, and this is really something I'm ashamed about, this isn't hyperbole, that I got the idea of writing this poem from a New Yorker article, which just is absolutely shameful. The only thing worse is writing a poem after seeing a PBS special. Don't ever write poems after you've seen a special on, like, physics or something. Just no end of bad poems about bubbles. I don't remember anything about this article other than the word air light, which was coined to describe a certain quality of light that is unique, according to the author of this article, to Southern California. So this is a... I was rereading this today and thinking, yeah, this makes sense. This is an apocalyptic poem, and we're living in apocalyptic times, and we'll all have to wait a little longer to retire after today, among other things. The apocalypse of Wall Street following the hurricane. Air light. Beseechments begin with certainties, that there is no one left to love, that the desert has drifted inward to steady us like salt packed in a viscera for the long journey to the afterlife, that the deep marine canyon between Los Angeles and Catalina has filled with light. The cephalopods and lanternfish dazzled nearly to death in their blindness, that nothing, pure nothing, is the glove of shadow cast by a frond. And so the air light at dawn in the clean streets of San Marino thins the surface of an instant until it cracks like varnish and the emptiness beneath is released. In the history of the color blue, a page has been left blank for this, the way the yellow light of the underworld stains the sky. The man standing in the steam says, if only, if ever, if instead. And the common prayer begins, please, no weather, no temblors in the bones of the night. 10 months without anything but light, a drought, a desert. 2 months of rain and the levees of broken promises, the old farms flooded, the chimneys and rooftops, an archipelago of faith where once was certainty. On the clean streets of Pasadena, a boy too young to care, can't bear to let the sticky lollipop lie on the sidewalk, picks it up, begins to lick. In other words, it's normal, even if it hurts. The sickness beneath the footstep, the light dissolved in flood, the crime instead of hope, the poppies springing from ash in the aftermath of this year's fires. All right, Western Sky, which is the title of a song. I do rip off a lot of music. A song by the American Music Club, a band nobody here has heard of. And they have a wonderful song about Lazarus, which got me thinking about that most human of Bible stories. This also has JPL in it, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I grew up around 2 miles from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And just up the hill from JPL is Mount Wilson, which used to be one of the most important telescopes in the world until LA got so bright. And now I can't see a thing. Western Sky. Lazarus could never remember which pocket he put his hand in when those crowding around asked to see the holes, mistaking him for someone else. And the many melding lights of Los Angeles are visible from the moon, or so says my friend at JPL, who should know. He mans the telescope on Mount Wilson, which stares these days at a drop ceiling. Nevertheless, it sees. It is like closing your eyes and watching the flecks of dream left over from the night before. My friend spends his nights alone looking for what? He can't say. It seems we all want to see new worlds, the planet nearest the silver star, the frozen sun. We all want to know it didn't hurt. The sentence slipped like a burning cigarette into someone's ear. How the once best friend declares his love for whom you loved and it doesn't hurt. After all, it's always better to know. Though how much longer do we expect to live? And will it sear and scar this new knowledge? Will it join the other blue marks not fading from sight? Those strange hard shadows, not wrinkles or lines exactly, but fossil traces of every sweet truth, as if we could ever learn and let it go. When Lazarus asked for water, someone said, tell us first your story, my friend, then drink. Here was proof that the body endures. Thirsty or not, we go on. Though how quiet and cool it had been, he said, and how very much he now needed water. And when finally allowed to die, he rose swiftly and saw how the ocean shaped the slivers of land, how they lit the world a warm, soft blue, as if a family had gone to bed forgetfully, leaving the television on, its light a little fuzzy behind the curtains. The Joy Addict. Whales fall slowly to the ocean floor after dying and feed the vertical nation for years. Like Christ, who feeds us still, they say, though I don't know. But imagine it, fish chasing through the bones or nibbling what's left, the whale when it finally touches bottom, an empty church. Forget all that. It's intended to soften the skin, like apricot seeds and mud or boredom. The drift of worlds in a given day can turn a telephone to porcelain, open graves in the sidewalk, so that who knows why thinking about thinking leads to new inventions of grace that never take, never leave to say what to do with grandmother, who is determined to live beyond her usefulness, which is fine, but why won't she relax and wash the sea with me? I wish someone would intrude on all this. People grow tired explaining themselves to mirrors, to clerks administering the awful perfume. I ask a Liberace lookalike, why do you dress that way? What way, he says. Then he's right. Who taught us to bow our heads while waiting for trains, to touch lumber without regret and sing privately or not at all, to invest the season with forgiveness and coax from it a hopeful omen? Lord knows the hope would heal this little fear, but who taught us to fear? Soon branches crackle in the windy heat like something cooking too quickly, dogwood lathering the empty woods, and everyone looking for a commitment of permanence from summer, from someone else. Two deer, the color of corn, disappear into an empty field, and I wait beside the road for them to move. I want to see them again. About, 19 years ago? Yeah, the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia. I didn't write this poem 19 years ago, but at some point I got on this kick where I wrote a bunch of poems about imaginary revolutions, including many I was thinking of for the United States. And this is one of them. And only two remain, and I'm going to read them back to back. This was really a fun exercise. How would we best overthrow the government? Now, they waited for the music on the radio to stop, and it did, though somehow a few seconds passed before they noticed, much the way a day ends with a silvering gone gray, darkness, a hand on the shoulder, a hug. It sits with you, filling the room with its silence. The message that followed was meant to soothe as it shocked, like the end of a fairy tale whispered to a child at the edge of sleep, now. And even for them, enlisted to a duty they were old enough to love, even they felt the feather blows of a dream, that hush of breath that arrives like a breeze through a window, a dry kiss, the ghost already closing the door behind it. She retrieved the small pistol from its velvet sack in the bread box. He fit barrel to stock and oiled his grandfather's rifle. There was time, though quickly, to lick each other's closed eyes, a ritual of sorts, his sweat on her tongue, the bitter taste of mascara across his gums. Offshore, beyond the breakwater, the pirate station ended its broadcast and released a single horn blast, as if entering a slender bank of fog, a decorative blast for a quickly passing vapor. And what followed was the rumble of 1,000 shoes on concrete. He paused to let the cat in as she filled its dish an extra inch, enough for days or forever, who knew? Simply put, the long wait was over. And as they began to run with half the town toward the harbor and the congregation site, he saw the bright dome of the Capitol ignite with sunset, its copper tiles of flame. And he remembered four children long ago on the municipal beach, his brother's foot bandaged in strands of jellyfish, one sister screaming as the other continued digging, her plastic pail filled with wet sand to drip into spires. The horizon had seemed a botched watercolor of sun over sea, a stain of orange that made the sky a tissue torn with fire. He had run for his mother with a joyful panic, knowing his mission was of mercy. His brother's pain as vast and distant as the execution of innocence witnessed from afar, a television flickering in a peaceful land. As now he ran with his wife, the rifle easy in his arms, their pockets jingling with keys and coins, skeletons, quarters, and dimes, they would melt into bullets. So I think I probably did write that about 10 years ago. And here's one I wrote. I'm still working on this project. Here's one I wrote a couple of months ago. Another revolution poem. Whatever needs to be explained really doesn't. Just pretend it's not important. Okay. Just I think that's actually important to say a lot of times. None of these references are relevant. They're just here to supply texture. A wooden horse. We tied ropes to it and pulled. It rolled a little, and then enough to cross the drawbridge, which we drew back shut and locked with iron rods. Nick and Sally climbed the tower and crouched low behind the parapet to take their turns watching the south, from whence cometh nearly everyone we had ever hated. We'd heard the rumors and knocked, but the thing was all echoey and empty, though inside we found flowers and enough red wine to tip the town into dreams of poppies and fair weather. Salvador sang the ballad of Queenie and Rover, while Ted sliced the ham and spread mustard on bread, and Evangeline for once let down her black braid and taught the kids the cha-cha. We were ready when they charged, daisies behind our ears. Whosoever steals will be blinded, Jamal cried as if reading from the dictionary. Salvador kept singing, and we offered the immigrants leftover salad and what little ham remained. It was better before we were barbarians, Franny whispered. But they'd given us the wine and wrapped it in wood and sent us a hollow horse to hold our dreams in case our hearts at last were full. See, it started out a poem, you know, just a rewriting of the Odyssey, and or just thinking about, I always rewrite the Odyssey, really, but then it ended up being about immigration policy. Which, come to think of it, the Odyssey is about immigration policy. The Iliad is, that's for sure. All right. Never mind. I'm going to read some newer poems. I think I read this last summer, but I'm not sure. I actually wrote this poem and wasn't conscious until 6 months later. I was conscious when I wrote it, but I wasn't conscious until 6 months later. I pretended that I wasn't thinking about the Odyssey when I wrote this poem, but listen to the name. I had no idea I was doing this. You know, when's the last time any of you read the Odyssey? It's been years for me, but somehow these names keep creeping in. I thought I was just writing about the bus station down here on Walnut. Truly, that's all I intended. It's called Friday Rich, Saturday Poor. The swans follow Helen, a sandwich in her pocket, and now she's screaming at her boyfriend, "Thank you for making me beg," as he rides away on his Schwinn waving one finger. Beneath the bridge, the smell of batteries and goose shit. My kids like that. The smell of old wool all wet with fog and breath. The smell of Friday night. The smell of clear air beaten blue by spray paint and rotten fruit. Even Hector has a check to cash, and we're all wondering where to go first. The liquor store on Beecher's or the sub shop near the bus station. I wish Helen's phone would stop ringing. I never understand the Rivertown girls with their frayed sleeves and pearls like broken teeth around their necks, at their wrists. If we hurry, we can spend every dollar by dawn. The smell of iron, or the taste of it. The look of Helen all stoned and happy in a gas lamp's gold glow. The look of beer in a glass. The look of polished wood. The ring stains and puddles. The letters carved with a penknife. Friday is a kiss. I don't get the steam on the river. I wish the moon would stop shaking. I wish Saturday would still stay still on the other side of midnight. There's a little girl, or Helen, staring at a shop window, waiting for the mannequin to move. Okay. All right. What are you doing? Phoebe was cheering, silently. It seems like yesterday, but several years ago, Amanda and I were watching To Catch a Thief. It was as if we were watching it for the first time. Maybe we were, but we paused because there's this great monologue of Cary Grant's, who's John Robey. And he says, and I quote him, "You know, I have about the same interest in jewelry that I have in politics, horse racing, modern poetry, or women who need weird excitement.
Good company.
Yeah. So I was thinking about the last time I saw Cary Grant. Really, this is, no, I'm not going to say it. You decide. Cary Grant. The last time I saw Cary Grant, he was tearing apart bread at the marina. A cloud of gulls around him. He let me try on his glasses, those heavy black specs he wore toward the end, and I bought a pair just like them, though I didn't look like Cary Grant, so I went back to not trying. The night before he died, Cary called from Iowa to talk, just to talk. He said about David Niven, he never wore blue out of doors, though every pair of pajamas was a different shade of sky. When his voice dropped, I thought a flock of sparrows had landed all at once somewhere on the line between Davenport and Los Angeles. Sometimes, he said, David held my hand while we walked, while we talked over coffee, while we smoked on his patio. He had a lovely pink house on Amalfi Drive. Sometimes we just sat there watching the gardener prune the bougainvillea, listening to traffic on Sunset Boulevard. It was as if only half of what he was saying could be put into words. Cary was quiet a while before he said, "Good night, my dear." I sat without hanging up and listened to the dial tone, waiting for the sparrows to lift, to go find another voice. What did Dudley say to the bishop at the end, a little wistfully as he watched the window for a last look at Julia? "I want to be far, far away from here." Away from what, I've always wondered, though that's the half that can't be said. A dial tone, a hush, a blue hum in a sky filled with gulls. I didn't ask for his glasses that morning at the marina. He just handed them over. "Wait till you see what I see," he said. And he held my hand while he looked. How many of you believe that's true? I wish. As I always say, if there's any of these that you don't think really work, don't tell me. This is a love poem, and also very simply an experiment in sort of cinematic narrative. It's called "Were Two Cans Tied Together with String." One. My wife sings like laughing water in a pot, peels onions for a stew that will by evening's end simmer with the old earth smells of lamb and rosemary, potatoes and saffron, all other scents just quiet clamor in the steam leaking out the open window above the sink, where minutes ago she gathered in the bird and kissed the gray down of its neck before tugging loose the note before returning it to the air. I fell asleep mid-afternoon and woke to bells and the dusty tin notes of an antique piano, flurries aging the early evening. I made a sandwich of mustard and cheese, stood at the window watching the music blow with snow in the backyard. I wrapped around my pigeon's rickety left leg a Chinese fortune and climbed the rope ladder to the roof to let it go. Once, I hid a love note in her sock drawer and waited months until she found it. By then, nothing had changed, which is a way of saying love is a glacier devouring the daisies in a mountain meadow. They disappear so slowly, we forget to remember the beauty. I slid the cold pigeon inside my shirt before returning it to the cage. My wife was singing Ruby May, the window still open enough to let out the song with all that steam, the sounds beneath the smells, how a voice changes over time and distance, or it doesn't. Poem about my iPod, but it's too long. This is another love poem, and it's from a series I'll talk about in a second. First day of spring, the day my eyes came back. There are three songs in her hand. The orange tastes like a hoofprint. First days are velvet slippers in the trees, all these worms in an old soup can, river of solder, river of twine. The river holds the earth in place as it spins loose its loose leaves. I'm tired of budding into air too clear to swallow. The day my eyes came back, she walked through the door like a blue shout in the silver dusk. I still got your venom in my mouth. She held my kiss beneath her tongue, touched my neck, found the cobweb in my voice and brushed it loose. Don't bruise your knees, the one song goes. Please. I wrote a series of poems based on songs by Grant McLennan, a songwriter who died a few years ago, who's very important to me. And this is another one. And this one's for Phoebe and Walt, because Phoebe loves this song. It's called Comet Scar. Isn't that a great name? Comet Scar. My sister once gave me a comet scar. She got me with her nail right under my cheek. It took me about 6 years to get rid of that. Comet Scar. For months after his death, Phoebe sings along in the back seat to Comet Scar without a word except the words to the song. Then one day she asks, what's a comet scar? And I say, it's what's left from coming so far. A scar on a girl who knows more than ordinary people ever know. But those are just the lyrics, and she's already heard them, though she doesn't argue. Now she's singing 1+1, which doesn't require explanation since 1+1=2, she says, and she's sure. But two ones never add up to anything in the song, which is about love and its aftermath, and someday she'll ask about that. Maybe it will be the day she says, who's singing? And I'll tell her. And like always, she'll follow up with, is he alive or dead? Which she gets from her older brother, who's not happy that Basil Rathbone is no longer with us, and checks nearly every day to see if Johnny Depp is still around. Film is tricky that way. So I guess I'll tell her no, he's not alive. Though instead, perhaps, we'll listen to Finding You, his last AM hit, where he asks, what would you do if you turned around and saw me beside you, not in a dream, but in a song? And without looking in the rearview mirror, I'll say, can you see him beside you, Phoebe? And I know she'll say yes, because she believes in all sorts of things she can't see, which is a kind of seeing. And while the song is playing, and maybe longer, we'll both sing along, which is a kind of seeing. All right, two more poems. I forgot to read this other one. It was in my celebrity sequence. Do you remember the one about Cary Grant? It's been hours. Well, this one is even better. But I'm not going to tell you who it's about. You'll know. This is one of those dreaded things that really happened. Well, I don't think there's anything requiring explanation. Just in case it goes by too fast, there's lots of paintings mentioned in this poem, all of which are in the Art Institute in Chicago. And the title's from John Keel's Antarctica Starts Here. We never spoke, though I'm sure we met while staring at bathers by a river. Late winter light through high windows, frosting her strangely brown hair, wrapped close in ermine, the only concession to disguise. She held with two fingers her white Chanel sunglasses, lifting them now and then while staring hard to chew softly on an arm. Anyone could see it was her, though no one else did. We love the same paintings, I like to think. O'Keeffe's Sky Above Clouds, Nighthawks, of course. And we took the same time in each gallery. After a few hours, she turned and nodded thanks and left. No entourage or bodyguard, no one even to carry the bag of books she bought in the gift shop. Did I volunteer to help and say in passing, as I held the door open to Michigan Avenue with one hand, the bag of books in the other, that if I were given just one meal and one movie to end my last day on Earth, I would go hungry and ask for both Belle de Jour and Les Derniers Metro. I watched her walk away beneath the lights that stretched from Barbary to here and felt the air return to normal in my lungs, though for hours I smelled her perfume in my shirt whenever I lifted a sleeve to my face. Her own perfume, as it turned out. She was in town to debut De Neuve, a fragrance as chic as its namesake, I read in the Tribune the next day, alongside a note in the gossip column, 200 roses delivered to Catherine Deneuve's suite at the Drake. Did I volunteer? Did I say? Did I send 200 roses? I was the only one who recognized her. Isn't that astonishing? I think I've gotten all right. One more poem. I think I ran out of poems. So this is, thank you very much. You've been nice. When I was a little boy, I put that scar about, remember I just thought of that scar for the first time in 10 years, but actually it's in this poem. There you go. And when I was a little boy, my grandfather, after he died, would come and visit me every night for like 3 or 4 months. It was just so vivid, and I always was impressed by that. So this final poem is called Another. No one needs another ghost story except my son, who waits hard outside the door to dreams to hear mine all the way through. What room, what house will he remember as his first? Which ghost? I woke each night for weeks to find my grandfather watching, sitting at the foot of my bed, waiting for my eyes to open. He never spoke, just shifted away from the streetlight falling through the window his face dissolving into shadow like a photograph dropped in a puddle. Sometimes his glasses caught the light and turned to white, his eyes vanishing for long seconds until his head turned again toward a sound at the door. My mother come to check on me, his daughter, wondering how I was, wondering if somehow he really was back. She told me once she saw him too. I tell my son, it's true, it's true. Though he's given up, is sleeping west of anywhere. Outside, a crescent moon is pasted to the night sky like a scar on a little boy's suntan cheek. I touch it as he sleeps, believing all I can feel or see or remember. Thank you.